podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello, welcome to the Snooker Scene Podcast. I'm Dave Hendon. Each evening from December to December, before you drift asleep upon your cot, think back on all the tales that you remember of Camelot. And of course, for Camelot, we mean the Crucible, because this is a special episode. Looking back, I've asked for listeners' memories, iconic moments of the Crucible. So iconic moments of the Crucible. We've had a lot in, and we're going to be going through them. And at the end of the episode, I will present my top 20. It's based on my personal choices. But a lot of those, of course, will already have been mentioned by the listeners. But before we get to that, we have had a little bit of follow-up. By the way, the World Championship's starting soon. That's why we're doing it. But we've had a bit of follow-up from the Women's World Championship. Now, Matt Hewitt was there for the WPBSA. He made a speech, but Matt is the media officer for the Women's World Snooker. And he said a correspondent inquired as to what the sound of birds chirping about during coverage of the Women's World Championship in China. While it would be tempting to let conspiracy theories grow, having been on site, I can share the mundane truth that it was exactly as sounded, with birds enjoying their day on the roof of the venue. Unfortunately, I cannot help with the mystery of the Crucible table, however. Well, of course, that's 1983. That doesn't feature in the iconic moments countdown, but the Werbeneck Taylor thing. I think we've discussed that too much. But Matt also says, and this is on the theme of the World Championship, he says, as I was catching up on the latest podcast, I was happy to hear some of your correspondents reminisce about the montage, gold, D-ream and all, shown during the World Championship during the late 90s and early 2000s. For me also, it was this 15-minute or so montage that I recorded and rewatched repeatedly during those pre-internet days, and which largely framed my knowledge and understanding of the sport as a young fan. I particularly remember excitedly calling my mum, who could not have been less interested, to watch the montage as Stephen Hendry potted that cutback black for the 147 once again. Of course, fast forward 20 years, and now whether a pro snooker blog or the WPBSA say, I've got to know and in some cases work with many of the gods on these montages, much like yourself, of course. But when watching this and some of the other famous montages discussed, the power of nostalgia always transports me back in time to my first bedroom and watching these clips in awe. I think this will be a running theme, Matt, of the podcast this week. The memory is very strong in all of this, of course. And that comes with the continuity of the Crucible, because it's always been, okay, the set's changed and sponsors have changed, but that venue and all the moments in that venue, that's why we remember it. It's a bit different with some other tournaments, like the UK Championship, you know, a great historic event, but it's moved around. Even the Masters has kind of moved around a bit. But since 1977, as we know, the World Championship has always been at the Crucible. And, of course, it will be again this year. Now, the other, just one, a little bit of follow-up as well from Lewis, who was actually at not only the Women's World Championship, but also the recent World Open in Yushan. So we've got from the, I don't want to call him a horse, but from the horse's mouth, about these two events. So Lewis writes, I've just returned from 2 weeks in China, primarily to attend the Women's World Championship and the World Open. As always, on my return, I listened to your latest episode of your podcast. Whilst in China, I was unable to use social media, but according to one of your listeners, there were plenty of tweets from some birds nesting in the rafters of the Changping Gymnasium. I think they actually may have got into the air conditioning system, or perhaps were close enough so their chirps were amplified all around the arena, like an echo chamber. Well, ironic really, Lewis, because Twitter to a lot of people is an echo chamber, but we continue. The air conditioning system itself was quite severe, although not as noisy as it may have sounded on the live stream. It was pretty cold during the first half of the tournament. By the weekend, it was fine, perhaps because the number of spectators had swelled to over 200 for the semi-finals and over 700 for the final. The tickets were free, just requiring the swipe of a QR code. It seemed as if passers-by in Dongduan could have been attracted in to take a look, particularly as a Chinese girl was doing well. Now that Bai Yulu has become a big star in China, it's possible that next year's final could attract as many as 1,000, presumably a record for any snooker world championship. I then moved on to Yushan and was lucky to have a front row seat for Zach Surety's 147 against Ding Junhui on the first evening. It was quite a strange layout, with the six outside tables in three-sided cubicles, and the audience looking right down onto the table. However, the players I talked to said they were fine. If they keep a similar schedule next year, I'd highly recommend the trip for any travelling snooker fans. Watching a bit of both tournaments back-to-back is pretty good value, although getting from Dongguan to Yushan overnight is dicey. Indeed, it would be a big problem if any of the women involved in the latter stages had to play in Yushan on the Monday. But the venues and the organisation were excellent. These felt like really top-class international sporting events, which is not always the case in some of the tournaments closer to home. So there we are. We've got direct reportage there from Lewis. And thank you for that. But we're now going to move on to... This is a special episode for Easter, as we're just a couple of weeks away now from the World Championship. As we listen... Well, I say listen, I've got to read them out. But but as I read out listeners' iconic moments of the Crucible, I think we should start by explaining what we mean by iconic. It's really memorable and standing for something more than just what it was. So it represents something else. So, for example, and we'll get to maybe Alex Higgins crying in 1982. It's not just a sportsman crying because he's won and he sees his baby. It explains something about him himself and the time itself. And it stays in your memory because of that. A lot of things are called iconic that are not. But these, hopefully, most of what we talk about here will be. And it's important to say they're moments. These are not the best matches played. So, top of my head, 1988, Jimmy White beat Stephen Hendry in an absolute classic in round two. That's not in this list because that's not a moment. That's a match. Moments have to be exactly that. It's almost like sometimes a single image that you remember. And that's going to be... That's going to form the basis of this discussion. But obviously people have their own... They can go their own way, really. And Lee Wall, now he's done a top 10 in backwards, and he hasn't explained what they are, but I'll just briefly explain them. I think people will know anyway. So number 10, Barry's Hug, that's 81. Barry Hearn barreling into Steve Davis after Steve wins his first world title. Number 9, I'm in the final now, you know. That's Terry Griffiths, 1979, when he wins his semi-final to David Vine. That's what he says to him. Number 8, Ronnie's Hug. Of course, that's with Judd Trump from 2 years ago in the final. After the final, I should say. 7, He's Beginning to Annoy Me. 30 years ago now. 30 years ago, Jimmy White made that comment after losing yet again 4 times in finals to Stephen Hendry. Number 6, 69. That's the Alex Higgins break in 82 against Jimmy White that saved the match. Number 5, The Finger Wag. That's Dennis Taylor, 85, after winning the title. 4, Good Luck Mate. Cliff Thorburn, 83, the maximum. Of course, Jack Carnham's commentary. 3, 5 minutes, 8 seconds. That's Ronnie's maximum record time in 1997. Number 2, My Baby. That is the aforementioned Alex Higgins beckoning his baby after winning in 82. And number 1, Simply No. And that is, of course, what Ted Lowe said when Steve Davis missed the black in 85 against Dennis. So that's a fine start. That's a punchy start from Lee. And we move on. And people, you know, you could either explain these or just list them, and that's, we've got a mix of them. So Jonas has said, moments I can think of in random order, I didn't start watching until the mid-90s, so I don't have that many moments from before that. So he's got Mark Selby's 147 in the final, that's last year. Of course, Cliff Thorburn's first maximum, 83. Stephen Hendry's last in 2012. Steve Davis beating John Higgins in 2010. Stephen Hendry's 7th title. The 85 final. The 2 qualifiers winning, Terry Griffiths and Sean Murphy. Steve Davis's retirement. A streaker, that was, I think it was 04 maybe, the streaker. Jimmy White's final results. Well, there's a lot of those, but yes, I mean, they're all memorable. They're all memorable in their own way, of course. Christine. I'm not going to discuss these too much because I've got my own list at the end and they cover a lot of what we've heard from listeners here. But Christine says... I don't seem to associate snooker with music at all, but the first 10 iconic images I thought of were... Now, of course, this is not the World Championship, I've just realised, but anyway, a lot of the bar, actually. So, OK, we'll allow a diversion into other tournaments for now. We're just messing around on a podcast. Ronnie and Paul Hunter with long hair and Alex Bands, when a young hot Jan Verhaas refereeing. Number 2, Hendry's look of confusion at Jan when Ronnie walked off. Of course, that was... the UK Championship 2006. Number 3, the Ali Carter shoulder barge with Ronnie. Number 4, Steve Davis sipping his water. Of course, that could be any tournament in the 80s. Number 5, Ronnie and Ding's emotional hug at the Masters Final 2007. Number 6, Ronnie's chalk action mime after his fastest maximum. That was at the Crucible. Number 7, Hazel Irvin, serious look on her face after John Higgins on the front of the News of the World. Number 8, Willie Thorne. Willie Thorne crying picture. Despair at gambling problem. I'm not sure what that actually is, but anyway. Number 9, Vicky Selby on the Crucible balcony. Again, that could be any final, basically, in the last decade. Vicky always has to sort of sit through it all. Number 10, the iconic Hendon Yates ITV fist bump. Oh, all I'll say about that is, Christine, one take. One take, we nailed it in. Phil, if you watch it back, was a bit more exuberant than me. But anyway, that's true in general. Now, John has sent his in, so here we go. In response to your quest for listeners to share their top 10 Crucible moments, I didn't need a second invitation, as lists like this are right up my street. My list is below, and I've been very strict with the definition of what an iconic moment is. In my opinion, it's something that lasts for seconds rather than minutes and sticks in my mind for years to come. That's exactly what I was looking for, John, I have to say. For this reason, I couldn't think of any top 10 iconic moments that featured the King of the Crucible, Stephen Hendry, because even his seventh win in 1999 didn't come with a moment that sticks in my mind. So without further ado, my list is as follows. Also, please forgive me for compiling a top 11, as I didn't want to leave any out. So number 11, the crowd welcoming Judd Trump and John Higgins to the arena for the final session of the 2011 World Final. Number 10, Mark Selby leading the crowd with a Mexican wave after his 147 in the 2023 final. Number 9, Rob Walker mistakenly introducing Steve Davis as Dennis Taylor to the final session of his 2010 quarter-final match against Neil Robertson. Number 8, the Just Stop All protest at the 2023 World Championship. Number 7, Ronnie O'Sullivan embracing Judd Trump after he captured his 7th Crucible Crown at the 2022 World Championship. Number 6, Jack Carnham uttering the words "Good luck, mate" to Cliff Thorburn for the first Crucible 147. Number 5, Ronnie O'Sullivan potting the final black for his 147 against Mick Price in 1997. Number 4, Barry Hearn bear-hugging Steve Davis after he won his first world title in 1981. Number 3, Jimmy White's missed black in the final frame decider of the 1994 World Championship. Number 2, Alex Higgins' tears to hold his daughter after his 1982 win. And number 1, it'll be a drum roll here, I suppose, but anyway, number 1, Dennis Taylor potting the final black in the 1985 World Final to defeat Steve Davis. I appreciate I've included a controversial one at number 8, as what Just Stop All did was completely wrong, though I still think it's an iconic moment that should feature on my list. Also, with numbers 10 and 11, these iconic moments may only feature in the lists of those who are in the arena at the moment, which I was. So that's Trump and Higgins being introduced and Selby with his Mexican wave after the maximum. I don't think these moments came across as strongly to TV viewers, but because it's my list, I wanted to include them as very special memories. It's perfectly fine, John. It is personal. That's the whole point of it. If you're keen to continue these top 10 lists in the build-up to the Crucible, may I suggest a top 10 list of Crucible shocks, as that would include many more moments and memories I cherish. Thanks for reading. Well, thanks for sending it in. Now, Cameron Hutton, here we go. So he's got three here. So number 1, Mark Allen's loss to Chow Yupeng, very unfortunate to foul on the last black, that would have kept him in the match. This moment is lightly helped by John Verger's commentary as the white sunk into the yellow pocket. No disrespect to Mark, but this moment always sticks in my head. Number 2, the longest frame ever at the Crucible between Mark Selby and Yanbing Tao. Always nice to witness a bit of history in real time, and this frame was the culmination of a really enthralling affair. Of course, that was one with the pigeon. I don't know when anyone's written in with the pigeon. There was a controversy, but there was a Chris Downer, who of course produces the excellent Crucible Almanac, and the new one is out, by the way. Last year I was fascinated to see. I was counting down the days to see how Chris had dealt with the pigeon. And I thought he'd have its own special section, and it didn't. But he's, and this is classic Chris, his rationale was it was between frames. So it didn't actually interrupt play. And he's absolutely right, it was between frames. Mark Selby had gone out, the pigeon appeared, and then, of course, as Selby came back in, the pigeon nearly took his head off. But anyway, getting waylaid by pigeons here. Number 3 from Cameron. Ronnie's 92 clearance in the 2012 final, still to me one of the most impressive clearances I've ever seen, especially after a couple of misses at the start of the respective frame. Even when he looked in trouble, the Rocket pulled off some phenomenal pots to stay at the table and clean it up. Absolute genius, to the point of confusing Dennis Taylor and Willie Thorne in the comms box with his shot choice. Thank you very much. Now then, Wayne Griffiths, of course, whose father, Terry, won the World Championship in 1979, says, some thoughts in reply to your shout-out for iconic Crucible moments, in no particular order. Apologies for stating some of the obvious. Well, that's the point, I suppose. So, number 1, with no apologies for bias, I'm in the final now, you know. Terry to David Vine after his marathon win over Eddie Charlton, 1979 semi-final. Number 2, Cliff Thorburn's fluke and first ever Crucible maximum, and then at the end, good luck, mate, and the group hug with Terry and Big Bill Werbeneck. Number three, Steve Davis's theatrical and delayed leap after making the long black to beat Doug Mountjoy 18-12 and lift his first world title, followed shortly by Barry Hearn running on and almost knocking Steve over. Number four, Ronnie's seventh world title and pure emotion, 2022 of course. Number five, Alex Higgins's 82 family moment. Number six, Alex Higgins's clearance against Jimmy White. If one iconic moment, probably the long blue with screw inside and enough body movement to make every coach ask, why do we bother? Number seven, Ronnie's fastest ever 147 and asking for his chalk to be replaced. Number eight, Jimmy's missed black in the final frame against Stephen Hendry. Number nine, Alex sitting there with his drink, refusing to leave the arena at the end of his match career. Of course, that was against Steve James, 1990. He did play there again after that. And had a row with John Williams, as I recall. Played Ken Nocketty. And finally, from Wayne, Dennis's finger wag and that final black, 1985, of course. Looking forward to hearing yours. And you must have a few. Please include some of the press conferences, or we may not have seen so many of those behind-the-scenes moments, and others from your listeners. I actually made a choice. Thank you, Wayne. I made a choice, Wayne, not to include things from outside of the arena. So everything, I'm pretty sure, on my list is from the arena because they're shared moments. So, I mean, for example, I thought Mark Williams turning up to the press conference naked. That was on the list originally. But obviously the general public didn't see that. And by the way, he didn't want to. That was kind of iconic in a different way. But I've strictly kept it to the arena, the Crucible Arena. But anyway, there's no rules. I think I did Andrew's. Because it involves Stuart Bingham collapsing, which is a bit upsetting in retrospect. But anyway, Yarrow Warman. He's come up with one. He's from Duluth in the USA. He says Selby's 2014 World's Winning Pot and Victory Shout. Of course, he made that great clearance, Mark Selby. Who, by the way, is in the mixed doubles now because Mark Allen's withdrawn. So Mark Selby will resume his partnership from last year with Rebecca Kenner. They got to the final. Neil Robertson and Mick Nutshrup beat them. Henry Cutting. He says, in terms of iconic Crucible moments, instead of giving the obvious ones, such as Jimmy White's Miss Black in 94, Barry Hearn running on to hug Steve Davis in 81, or the famous 85 final, I thought I'd give you a list of my underrated iconic Crucible moments that perhaps won't be thought of, but in my opinion, should be considered for your overall list. Now, these are strictly my opinion only, and they've perhaps come in more recent times, as I was born in the mid-90s, but nevertheless, here they are. Well, say, Henry, it's all personal, so that's fine. So, firstly, Peter Ebdon's must make pink in the semi-final of the 2002 World Championship against Matthew Stevens, where he'd gone to win it. Nothing more really needs to be said on this. It took great nerves and bottle to take it on. Win the title off the back of this makes it iconic. Okay, Liang Wenbo's premature celebration to win the match against Joe Swale on his debut in the 2008 Worlds, where he fist-pumped after potting frame ball, only for Joe to get the required snookers and win the frame, although Liang would go on to win that match, I believe. Something about this match and that moment in particular always sticks with me. I think the fact the divider was lifted and it was like a one-table setup made it more thrilling. Joe Swale is also a very likeable character, and his celebration as he walked off after winning the frame was brilliant. Of course, Joe Swale, twice semi-finalist, successive years, 2000 and 2001. Mark Williams' shot against Barry Hawkins in the semi-final in 2018, where he was tied up on the top cushion, only to hit the red up the table off the bulk cushion and just knock the red in over the middle. This had Tiger Woods' 16th hole at Augusta vibes, as the ball seemed to hang over the pocket for half a second, then drop. This was at a very tense stage of the semi-final, and Mark will go on to win 17-15 and then win the final, which makes it an iconic moment. Deshawat Poomjang's hole appearance at the 2013 World Championship, where he beat Maguire in the first round and genuinely lit up the tournament with his infectious personality. Highlight was when he lost the frame after getting three misses in a row, and the manner of which it happened and the amusement of it all made it iconic. A less underrated one is the match between Ronnie and Selby in the 2020 World Championship and the passage of play in the deciding frame, where they kept snookering each other out of snookers, was one of the greatest semi-finals I've watched. I'm sure that if there was a crowd there, then it would go down as one of the greatest and most iconic moments in Crucible history. It was a shame there was no crowd, as I cannot imagine what the atmosphere would have been like. In the same breath, the other semi-final that day between Kyron Wilson and Anthony McGill also needs to be mentioned. An unbelievable exchange in the final frame between the two, which ended with Wilson fluking green to win, which would go down as one of the tensest frames I've ever seen. And once again, had there been a crowd, it would have drawn a lot more attention than it has. 186 points were scored in that final frame, which tells you all you need to know. Iconic. Lastly, although I wouldn't call this iconic, it's something I remember quite fondly and always thought was both amusing and unique, is the exchange in the 2019 final between Trump and Higgins, where Higgins was in a snooker and ended up going in off from the brown three times in a row in exactly the same manner when trying a two-cushion escape to flick off the reds at the table. It's something I just don't think will ever be repeated, and the way the two players, referee and crowd reacted just made it iconic for me. It would be good to know your thoughts and opinions from the list above, and although some of them are truly iconic, it would be good to see some of them considered in your final list. Loving the pod, and I'm hoping my favourite Sean Murphy can finally get his second world title next month. Well, thank you, and it doesn't. What I would say is they're in your list, which is good enough. What's in my list we'll come to later, but they're in your list, and good to revisit some of those. I mean, the two semi-finals are interesting, I think, because we'll never know if they'd have played out the same way with a crowd. You know, you would never know if that whole tournament would have played out the same way. But it was what it was, and it was still, even without a crowd, incredible viewing. It was at Friday, of course, that final semi-finals day, because it finished on a Sunday. Now then, Benjamin. Benjamin's got 10 here. He says, thanks, as always, for being such great company when watching any snooker match you comment on. Always finding new insightful things to share, but equally letting the snooker do the talking when it comes, when it matters. Hope to have you around for a long time to come. Well, that would be nice to think that, wouldn't it? Thank you, Benjamin. Your last podcast inspired me to write in with my own 10 most memorable snooker moments. I'm sure many listeners will share quite a few of these, but since I only started watching snooker in the mid-90s through Eurosport, in mainland Europe, most of my memories are from the last two decades. So here we go. Now, these are not strictly World Championship, but a lot of them are, actually. But anyway, it doesn't matter. So number 10, the final of the 2020 UK Championship between Neil Robertson and Judd Trump. It was behind closed doors due to COVID. It was a late night, and I remember sitting alone in my front room watching it all unfold. Judd and Neil were both gone in that last frame, with Neil slotting the pink in for the title. Yeah, it was long, and it was not the match we were expecting. I mean, they played Champion of Champions final, well, I think the year before, and there'd been eight centuries, same length of match, but this was a different sort of match. It got very slow towards the end, but compelling, and of course that's the great thing with snooker. You can get so many sort of different sorts of matches, different sorts of frames. Number 9, and remember this is general snooker, not just Crucible. Mark King's victory speech after winning the Northern Ireland Open 2016, a heartfelt and honest winner's speech, not shying away from showing his vulnerable side. It always makes me wonder when we'll ever know more about his current suspension. It feels increasingly unlikely we'll ever see him back on the circuit. Number 8, this one is very recent. Sean Murphy's 147 in the shootout. A remarkable feat at the best of times, but with the added time constraint, making it an unbelievable achievement. 7, there are many examples of remarkable clearances in snooker history, but for some reason this one always stayed with me, perhaps because it wasn't made by one of the all-time greats. It was in the first round of the 2016 World Championship. Martin Gould made one of the most unlikely clearances you'll ever see against Ding Junhui, a barrage of consecutive, ludicrously impossible shots that had no right of going in, but somehow just did. Towards the end, the pressure was off, but they just kept going in, just mind-blowing. Still widely available on YouTube today, having revisited it when writing this, it was once again an absolute treat. Yeah, I remember that. You're right, it was incredible. He's played some great snooker. I mean, he might be relegated from the tour, Martin. I know he's had, Martin Gould, this is, I know he's had health problems. It stopped him playing in several tournaments, but my word, what a talent. Number 6, Ronnie's 147 closing out the Welsh Open 2014 against Ding. The last red left-handed near the side cushion by the green pocket with position on the black was out of this world. His impeccable timing of achieving milestones at the culmination of a tournament just adds to why it's so hard not to consider him the greatest of all time. Number 5, he's back to the World Championship, the 85 final on the black. I never saw this live, which is probably why it's not higher in my list, but you can't love snooker and not know about this. It's just part of snooker folklore. An incredible event, elevated in my opinion by wonderfully witty Steve, delivering a fantastic one-liner just moments after suffering one of the most heartbreaking defeats one can experience. Yes, of course, it happened in black and white, was what Steve said after the final to David Vine. Number 4, Ronnie O'Sullivan's concession of his quarter-final match against Hendry at the 2006 UK Championship. Ronnie had always looked a bit fragile at times in those days, but usually clicked into gear when the challenge arose, but not that day. I remember seeing him implode live on TV and watched the BBC studio crew baffled by what they'd witnessed. Even the great Hazel Irvin was flustered, which added to the sense that something truly significant had happened. Number 3, the 2020 World Championship semi-final between Wilson and McGill, 16-all, with a spot in the final on the line. It's hard to remember a frame which had more oohs and ahs from the crowd. Well, of course, there wasn't a crowd. For it to be decided on a fluke as well was the twist nobody saw coming. The story overshadowed the next day's final, which featured Ronnie. That can be considered a rarity. Number two, the big man hug between Ronnie and Judd, having equaled Stephen Hendry's Crucible record, elevating himself to the undisputed GOAT. A once-in-a-generation super talent navigating his own demons along the way. Even he can't hide anymore just how much it meant. And to share it with another all-time greatest Judd was absolutely fitting. And number one, John Higgins' win in the 2011 World Championship, having come back from his sixth bunk ban in the final, he had to work hard to keep an emerging giant at bay in the former Judd Trump, seeing Higgins desperately trying to hold back the tears when Hazel mentioned his recent father's passing. Having lost my own father leading up to that tournament, it probably resonated more with me than other people. After having summed up my 10 moments, I'm almost sad that three of them had Judd Trump at the losing end of a big final. I suppose it's still a great honour to be part of snooker's great history. Thank you very much. Now, we continue. I read out Christine's email, and she emailed back to say, I wasn't listening probably, I didn't realise it was just the Crucible. Well, it doesn't matter, I've read them out anyway. You know, we're just messing around on a podcast. That's all this is, really. Dan at the Snooker Hall podcast says, my out-of-the-box suggestion for iconic Crucible moment is from 2019 when Dave Gilbert lost the semi-final in a deciding frame. The interview he conducted with Rob Walker immediately after is one of the most unforgettable moments in modern snooker. David struggled to hold it together, maybe because he knew he might never get another chance at reaching the final. And I think the reality of what he so nearly achieved hit him during those few moments with Rob. After fighting all the way to that stage, David came up short after a kick in the decider, and he just couldn't hide his regret at how events unfolded. His voice was breaking and his eyes were welling up. This was an incredibly touching human moment where Rob tried to ease the pain of someone who was clearly suffering in that moment. Rob literally put his arm around David. It showed the great character of both men, and it demonstrated why they're both so likeable. Okay, so it's not an entirely happy moment. However, for me, it was a wonderful reminder that the snooker players we watch and admire so much are real people. Yeah, I mean, that was pretty raw. I mean, the thing about that is that match, I think, often produces the most extreme emotions, actually. Not the final, strangely, but so often, because the semi-final, it feels like the longest match because it's 3 days. Obviously, it's two fewer frames, but because there's two matches to play in that period, it lasts longer. So you start on the Thursday, you finish on the Saturday. And if you're not in the final, you're not going to play the biggest match there is in the sport, the biggest occasion in the game. So it must be really raw to lose in a decider. The interview was done basically in the corridor rather than sort of taking Dave to a studio. They thought, we'll just get it out of the way now. And that corridor leads to the offices where the tournament staff work. And I can tell you there were a lot of people in tears there as well, genuinely. There was a lot of people backstage who, of course, were watching this who were also crying. A lot of people around and about the interview felt the emotion, because it was emotional. It just was. And that's the thing about this tournament. And it's because, I mean, people have said the semis are too long. I disagree. You probably wouldn't have got that if it had been best of 25. It's the effort and the time that you invest in these things. And to come up just short, as happened to Dave there, you know, obviously was very upsetting. Now, Phil Spivey, regular correspondent, he said, you asked recently for iconic Crucible moments to hear of mine. No doubt many will be covered by others too. 982, that's 69 break by Higgins. 983, Thorburn's 147. Even watching it back today, the tension is palpable. I still feel nervous thinking he might miss. The initial fluke, Werbeneck peering around the divide, that brilliant mid-distance yellow, Jack Carnham's good luck mate, and Thorburn singing to his knees after the final black, all combined to make it truly iconic. 985, Ted Lowe's no at the miss black by Davis, Taylor's cue aloft celebration. 1992, has there ever been a better debut performance than Peter Ebdon's? Beating Steve Davis 10-4 was an incredible way to announce himself on the world stage. Davis was still a top four player, yet Ebdon played fearlessly. The ponytail and the bold approach definitely proclaimed the arrival of a memorable character. 1996, O'Sullivan playing left-handed against Robidoux. 2011, the atmosphere at the start of the final session between Higgins and Trump, electrifying. 2020, those semi-finals, enough said. 2018, surely the greatest final of all. Plenty of finals have been dramatic, plenty have been of high standard, but has any final combined those two elements quite like Williams v Higgins? I would say no, personally, Phil. I think that is the best ever final. Maybe we'll do that as well, the best finals. And feel free to send those lists, although when we're going to record all this, I don't know. But anyway, 2023, Selby's 147 and the immediate aftermath with the extended ovation. Brussel with arms spread wide after potting the clinching balls, and the spirit in which the whole match was played. Compiling this list just reinforced the special nature of the Crucible. We don't just talk about the World Championship, but we nearly always refer to the Crucible, qualifying for the Crucible, Crucible moments, Crucible players and so on. What a venue, packed with memories. I don't want to sound like a dinosaur. I understand the commercial logic behind the possibility of moving, but it would be sad on many levels, probably irrational, but that's what sport is. Well, thank you, Phil. I'm sure many would agree with that. Simon Biggin, we're going to be bigging him up here. Sorry about that. He said, thank you for keeping us entertained with the podcast. Despite not winning any awards, it's the best there is. Well, thank you. Yes, maybe next year. Anyway, Al Pacino, I mean, it took years to win an Oscar. You know, all those great films he was in, The Godfather, Serpico, Dog Day Afternoon, Scarface, all of those. And Justice for All, that's a great film. Eventually won for Scent of a Woman, which isn't very good. Anyway, where were we? Oh, yes. My two favourite, for what it's worth, memories of the Crucible, amongst dozens of them, contain one man, Steve Davis. Yes, the hallowed final frame of the 1985 final against Dennis. Like most people who saw it, it will remain with us until we are no longer and hopefully beyond. I was 14 and watched to the end with my late father. We were gripped the whole evening at what was happening and the drama of that final as the final frame was played out in front of us in our living room on a black and white TV after midnight, despite having school the next day. The effort it usually took me to convince Dad to let me stay up to watch Minder or other such programmes which were not even as late as this wasn't needed. Strangely, I had no resistance on this night. My second moment was the time Steve announced his retirement to a packed Crucible Theatre, parading the trophy one last time to an emotional standing ovation. I was literally stood in front of my now colour TV, tears streaming down my face with a hurt in the back of my throat that you only get with such highly emotional times. I can genuinely feel it coming back while even typing this. Honestly, I get more emotional at such things the older I get. I guess we invest our time and emotions into something, someone, so much over the years, it affects us when these moments happen. Steve was my boyhood hero and still is to this day. Thanks, Dave. Looking forward to more Crucible memories from fellow listeners and indeed new memories, no doubt, being made in the next few weeks. Well, what a lovely email that is, Simon. And, yeah, I mean, I think you kind of say it there as well. I don't know when your father passed away, but maybe the memories of watching it with your dad, if he was no longer with you in 2016. Of course, Steve himself got emotional because his own father, Bill, had passed away just before that. Now, Mark Williams, but not that one. Now, this is not actually these are not actually iconic moments. This should have gone into a different category, but I'll read out anyway. My question for you is, with Sheffield just around the corner, what are recommendations for things to do, places to see, pubs and restaurants to visit when not watching the snooker? Out with the Crucible, are there any iconic snooker places or things to go and visit? One that springs to mind is the Cellar Door on the pavement outside the Brown Bear pub, where Steve Davis used to richly walk over it en route to the Crucible. I also plan to walk some of the recognised routes and canals in the area, but any recommended stop-off would be good. To be honest, thank you, Mark, to be honest, whenever I've been at the World Championship, I haven't strayed very far from the Crucible. I mean, the Graduate is the pub a lot of people go to. There's no getting away from that after play. They seem to stay open until people want to leave. I mean, you've asked for sort of cultural sites, and I've come up with a pub, which is not great, but anyone else, because all the years I've been going there, basically I've just been at the snooker, but anyone else with places to visit, I mean, it's a lovely part of the world, but I'm probably not the right person to ask about that. Now, I think we've got two more before I present my list. So this is from Florian, who writes, and Florian's in Vienna, Austria, by the way. Here's my personal list of iconic Crucible moments by decade, starting from the 1980s. The obvious ones are italic, just in case you want to skip them due to time constraints, and since probably everyone else will be having them on their list as well. Well, I'll read them all out. Why not? So the 1980s, Florian has 1983, Werbeneck peeking around the corner, Thorburn singing to his knees after the first maximum. 81, Barry Hearn tackling Steve Davis after his first World Championship win. 82, Alex Higgins, Bring Me My Baby. 85, Dennis Taylor, finger wagging and cue pumping. 1990s, Jimmy White, he's beginning to annoy me. 94, 97, Ronnie O'Sullivan demanding a chalk after throwing his own into the crowd following his 5 minute, 8 second maximum. 2000s, Peter Ebdon's brave pink against Matthew Stevens, we heard that from someone earlier, to extend and eventually win the match at 14-16 down. 2004, Ronnie O'Sullivan sporting fake teeth in his world title celebration. 2006, Paul Hunter's last match against Neil Robertson. Not a moment, to be fair, but the whole match was iconic in a very sad way. 2012, Stephen Hendry's retirement press conference. 2014, Ronnie O'Sullivan missing that pink in the final against Selby at 11 each. 2019, Judd Trump's maximum attempt, having potted an outrageously thin black, with me in the audience convincing him to go for it instead of the pink by shouting, "Come on!" A story previously told in an email in November 2022. Dennis Taylor on commentary there, willing the 14th red in, shouting, "Turn, turn." Needless to say, he missed that one. 2020, Anthony McGill offering a handshake after losing the semi-final against Wilson. Words to the effect of, "This deserves a handshake, not a then customary, due to the pandemic, elbow bump." 2022, Ronnie O'Sullivan and Judd Trump, a never-ending hug. Thanks for providing me with so much joy with your, in every capacity, bigger than World Snooker Tours podcast every week on my runs, commute and in my everyday life. Well, thank you. And he also says, "For months I've been eager to inquire about the Birmingham and Birth of the World Snooker Championship talk in September 2023. This was as part of Birmingham Heritage Week. Did you attend, as you said on the podcast? Was it any good? And is there any way to catch up with it on YouTube or a website?" I did attend. This was Thomas Bartley who put all this together and has now actually discovered the exact spot of where the first World Championship final was held, on John Bright Street here in Birmingham. It's now, I believe, it's a Brewdog pub now. But I think I did put the link to it. It definitely was recorded, so I'll see if I can find that. But it was recorded anyway, so I think it would be available to listen to, yes. Put it this way, it was full of detail, as indeed is Alpha Bonzi's email. So this is the last one from listeners about iconic moments at the Crucible. "Hopefully this isn't too late for your feature on iconic World Championship memories. Not being interested in snooker as a boy, the most it came to my attention in the early to mid-90s were news reports usually reporting on Hendry's latest triumph, trophy in hand, lazily acknowledging the applause. This went on until 1997, when Ken Doherty ended the Hendry run, and though I should have been in bed, I managed to catch the very end of the final plus the trophy presentation. That aroused, can I say that on this show, my curiosity, but I wasn't hooked until 2001, Ronnie O'Sullivan lands the title. His talent, as Phil Yates said, reporting for BBC Five Live, fully deserved. And again, I stayed up past my bedtime without anyone realising, watching the last 1.5 frames and silently praying that my snooker-hating mum wouldn't change the channel. 2005, the last Embassy-sponsored tournament, the first I could watch as much as I wanted, now being in a dorm room at uni rather than battling my snooker-hating family over the remote. I sat glued to my little TV as Sean Murphy held himself together, as some drunk in the crowd helpfully instructed him to pop the winning balls as the second lowest ranked champion ever. 2008, that Ronnie maximum, but not that one, so this is obviously a later one, but the first I'd ever seen as it happened, magical. 2011, the prolonged standing ovation as Higgins and Trump came into the arena for the final session of the final gives me goosebumps writing about it now. 2013, as does going to the Crucible for the first and so far only time to watch O'Sullivan's comeback match against Marcus Campbell. Fellow correspondents might remember the story. So excited about what we're going to see that me and my mate forgot to book a hotel room for the night. So excited about what we'd seen we missed our train home in the morning. 2016, Mark Selby's second world title was not an iconic moment in itself necessarily, but coming as it did the night he's Leicester City beat my Spurs to the Premier League title. Paraphrasing Kanye West, that night for him was dessert, and for me it was a disaster. I think that's the first Kanye West mention we've had on the podcast. Alpha's list continues. 2018, who can forget Mark Williams' third world title in that final with Higgins and that press conference after. 2019, not for smashing seven centuries in the final. No, the most iconic moment of the 2019 World Championship was the handshake and brief words of encouragement I gave Judd Trump when I worked at Stansted in the run-up to the 17 days. 2020, in a period we'd otherwise rather forget, those semi-final finishes one after the other, following the Jamie Clark, Anthony McGill, "You Want to Dance, Let's Dance" exchange, gave me some proper respite. So did this podcast, obviously. 2022, after O'Sullivan confirmed GOAT status with his seventh world title, that hug with Trump, which may still be going on now, gave me more goosebumps. There are plenty more iconic moments I've left out to keep this email to a reasonable length. Thank you very much. Well, there we go. So that is what a lot of memories there, personal. Some people at the Crucible watching them, and you know, great memories to look back on. And I've got my own, so I'm now going to present. I don't know why I'm building this up to be something. It's just a list, but anyway, I'm now going to present my own personal top 20 iconic moments of the Crucible. Now, of course, the problem, the long-established problem with lists is that very often people only talk about what's been missed out. So there'll be things in this list that you may have heard in those emails, and you might think, well, that should be in there. Well, it's my list, and I've come up with one I feel are in reverse order, and I'll explain each one, the 20 iconic moments of the cruise. But I'll just take a short sip of this beverage, and then we'll begin. Other podcasts would have cut that out, but anyway. So here we go. So we start at number 20, and we're going backwards, and it's been mentioned already, but this is, I think, quite a special moment, actually, and it sort of almost links, it's almost circular, as you'll discover why later. But number 20 is 2016, and it's Steve Davis's retirement. And Steve, I mean, obviously he'd sort of drifted away a little bit. He'd lost to Fergal O'Brien in the qualifiers, but we hadn't really seen much of him on the circuit, you know, in recent times. But he announced his retirement, and I think for a lot of us, that was a moment, because so many of us would have started watching snooker in the Steve Davis era, would have remembered how in the 80s it was always about him, who would beat Steve, or would anyone beat Steve, and of course usually they didn't. And there he was, walking out, applauded by his fellow champions and the Crucible crowd. They all stood up. Rob Walker interviewed him, he paraded the World Championship trophy. But as he explained, his dad, Bill, was always the driving force behind his career. He helped him with, you know, the Joe Davis coaching guide and all that stuff. Always been in his corner. Bill, going back, used to sit in the press room, front row, with his cigar, plumes of smoke in the air, like something out of Oppenheimer. It was one of the great sort of figures, you know, backstage. Always been in Steve's corner. He passed away, and Steve decided that was the time to stop. So that was the emotion, more, I think, than even stopping playing. It was the fact that his own life had kind of changed profoundly, and of course now he's gone in different and happy directions with his music. So that's number 20. Number 19 is from 1981, and this was, at the time, the highest ever break at the World Championship, Doug Mountjoy. And right at the end, the iconic moment, because as I say, it's about moments, it's about that picture that is in your mind of it. So he makes a 1-4-5 against Ray Reardon, and the crowd go mad. I mean, we think we have an idea of them as being more restrained maybe in those days, but they went wild. They were all on their feet. They'd seen something special. And what I loved was, the moment I loved was actually Ray Reardon. Of course, great champion in his own right, six times. He would have been favourite, I guess, for that match. It was a semi-final. Stepped forward full of smiles to congratulate Doug. You know, you could see he was genuinely happy. I mean, Ray would have loved to have made it. He was a very competitive player, but you could see in their handshake, two Welshmen, of course, two friends, that nice camaraderie of having shared a great moment. And actually put up on YouTube this week, there's a footage of Doug Mountjoy with David Vine in the BBC studio talking through the break, which is nice to watch. So that's number 19. Number 18. Now, this is very much just one moment, but I think it signifies something wider. It's from 1986, and it's the final, right at the end of the final. Joe Johnson, I mean, we talk about, you know, Jimmy White, Judd Trump as great entertainers. Joe played an extraordinary, attacking, fluent, entertaining game. And he's 17-12 up on Steve Davis, and he's potting the balls to win. The crowd are going mad. Obviously, he's a Yorkshireman from Bradford. They all absolutely love him there. And right at the end of the last frame, he pots a blue. He's playing basically exhibition shots. He pots the blue, and the camera just catches him. And the expression on his face, it's a mixture of a smile and complete disbelief. And I think that reflects what so many people thought in that moment. Because nobody thought Joe Johnson would win the World Championship that year. I don't think he thought he had much of a chance, really. He was number 16 seed. He was relatively unknown. 150-1 outside, all of that. Steve, yes, he'd lost to Dennis Taylor the year before in the final, but was widely expected to win. Joe played fantastically well, phenomenally well. But that one moment, he pots the blue, and the camera's on his face, and he's smiling, but there's also that look of complete disbelief. I'm world champion. And that, I think, is very much reflective of one of the great upsets at the Crucible. And it must be remembered, on British television, of course, in those days, it wasn't live around the world. There was no Eurosport. But on British television, that's the second most watched world final ever, after, of course, 1985, the year before. And I think that one moment just captures something quite special about that whole story. So that's number 18. Number 17 This is from 2014, and it is Mark Selby becoming world champion for the first time. Now, two players really have dominated the last decade at the Crucible. The last 12 years, you look at it, 8 of the last 12 world championships have been won by either Ronnie O'Sullivan or Mark Selby, because they came together in the final here. And Selby won it, okay, it was 18-14, but the way he cleared up, even that last black, I mean, I asked him about it, and I thought he would say he was sort of, you know, was thinking about the importance of it and under pressure, but he kind of wasn't by then. He kind of knew he won, and that says a lot about him, and maybe that's why he went on winning it. And I think that it's been mentioned by someone else, that potting the black and the celebration, you know, he's had to work so hard just to play snooker for a living, never mind win the world championship. And of course, he went on from that to keep on winning it, and was in the final last year, will be a big threat, I'm sure, this year. Number 16. Now, this has been talked about a lot already, but this is from 2020. This is Karen Wilson's fluke green to effectively beat Anthony McGill in that semi-final. The culmination of 4 sessions, 3 days of battle. The frame itself was incredible. I mean, if we were doing, you know, the best Crucible frames, top 10 Crucible frames, that would be in it, I'm sure. The fluke, what's kind of memorable about it? Yes, it won in the match, but his reaction to it, I mean, afterwards he was crying because he didn't want to win on a fluke. It's got to be pointed out, McGill, actually, if you scroll back a few minutes, he had the last red over the pocket, so he had a chance to win. He snookered himself on the yellow. So if that doesn't happen, Karen Wilson can't fluke the green. But people kind of don't look at it that way. But that fluke, it kind of summed up not only the sort of the madness of snooker, if you like, but also how luck does play a part in the sport. Even after 3 days and 4 sessions, one shot like that made a difference. Now, Karen may still have won despite that, but it certainly is very memorable. Number 15. Now, this is 2004. It was mentioned by one correspondent earlier. Ronnie O'Sullivan won the world championship, and they're presenting the trophy, and he puts these sort of false teeth in, these sort of jaggedy teeth. Now, I don't know to this day whether that was to do with Ray Reardon, who, of course, you know, Dracula and all that, and he was in his corner then, or whether Ronnie, I mean, I think he said at the time, actually, that his friend dared him to do it. It's the sort of thing, the reason I've included it is because it kind of sums up Ronnie O'Sullivan. No one else in that moment of winning the world championship would be putting false teeth in. It's not something on anyone's radar or any sort of priority. But Ronnie, being such an sort of off-the-wall character, a maverick, to use the term that we had explained to us a couple of weeks ago, it's something he did. And it is, whenever they show footage of that championship, that's what you see. And it kind of still, it's 20 years ago now, which is quite frightening in its own way, but it's still something that I think people certainly remember. And as I say, that image, you often see it. So that's number 15. Number 14, this also features Ronnie O'Sullivan. This is from 2022. The man hug with Judd Trump. Of course, Ronnie had just won his 7th world title. I think this is a really interesting moment. Of course, we've had a whole documentary where it features, the Edge of Everything film featuring Ronnie O'Sullivan. There was a lot in that, and I'm not a psychologist. I think most people would agree with that. But they were not, to me, they were not tears of joy. Sometimes you see people cry and it's kind of elation. To me, it was a kind of outpouring of all the mental strife he'd been through, everywhere he'd taken himself and pushed himself to, came out in that moment. He was crying, I think, partly out of relief that it was over, but also he'd been carrying a lot of emotion with him all through his life, really. And he's holding on to another player, someone he respects, someone who he knows looks up to him. Judd, in that moment, and we heard it on the documentary, spoke well. He just lost, and I suspect he didn't really want to be standing there hugging people, but he behaved brilliantly, actually. But yeah, it showed sort of heart on sleeve, yes, that it mattered, because he put himself out there to try and win the world championship, and I don't think anyone ever thought it didn't matter. But just the complex kind of whirl of emotion that's within him, it was fascinating to witness. And I think partly as well, you know, he's been brought up in a pretty tough way, really, a pretty tough world there in Essex, where you've got to be a man and all that, and you don't show your emotions. I think part of it, the reason the hug went on so long, is maybe he didn't want people to see him that vulnerable. But the fact that they did, I think, endeared him to more people than maybe before. I think it was quite a beautiful moment in a lot of ways. And raw as well, very raw. And that's what makes it iconic. Number 13, 2005, and it's Sean Murphy holding his arms aloft after winning the World Championship as a qualifier, only the second person to do that. And Clive Everton's commentary, amazing, astonishing, astounding. Those were the three words he said, and that completely summed up that moment. You know, he'd come through. It was a big tournament, that, because it was the last under Embassy sponsorship. And in a way, you couldn't think of anyone better to win it, because it was end of an old era, beginning of a new. Sean Murphy, a sort of new player, come out of not quite nowhere, because people had known about him for a while, but, you know, he wasn't predicted to be world champion that year by any means. And, yeah, that moment where he wins. And there's a slight look of disbelief, I think, in Sean, actually, as he wins it. Like, my God, I've actually done it. Because it was a close final, played brilliantly the last two frames against Matthew Stevens. But I thought Clive's commentary, as well as ever, amazing, astonishing, astounding, really underscored it brilliantly. Number 12 is from last year, 2023. It's Mark Selby having made the maximum at the World Final. And again, someone wrote in about this earlier. The Mexican wave, I mean, that's surely the first time we've ever seen that at the Crucible. In the middle of a World Final, which is a big match, of course, it was the first night of it, big match and tense and pressure and hard and all the rest of it. What I liked about it was Mark found time to acknowledge the crowd, to get them involved, understanding that maximums are not just about the players. We hear often about the money on the line for 147s and should it be more, but so much of it is about the audience and their enjoyment and what they take from it. And I think Mark understood that innately, actually, because I think he kind of, he's a people person, likes to talk to people, and he'll talk to snooker fans. And I think it was lovely to see him acknowledging the crowd and getting them involved in what was actually his moment, but also in a way it was their moment. Number 11 is from 1979. We've heard this as well. I'm in the final now, you know. Terry Griffiths, of course, the first qualifier ultimately to win at the World Final at the Crucible, the World Championship, I should say. Yeah, this was the semi-final, beat Eddie Charlton, long match. That's no great surprise with those two. Late at night, and David Vine sort of thrust the microphone under his mouth, and Terry said, I'm in the final now, you know. And what I love about this is the kind of innocence of it. Snooker, obviously, at this point, it had mainly on TV been pot black, and then bits of grandstand here and there and bits of coverage on ITV in the regions of various tournaments. But this was the first World Championship where the BBC devoted significant airtime to the World Championship, started showing it live, and it became more on the consciousness of the British public, and sort of started to embed itself in British culture. And Terry Griffiths was a big part of that, because he was a new player. He didn't represent the old guard, the Reardon, the Spencers, even the Higginses, the Chartons. He was new. He represented something different. And, of course, he'd had a life before snooker. He'd worked as an insurance salesman, a bus conductor, a postman, all that sort of stuff. And so he was very relatable. He had a young family. He was just a normal guy who found himself in an extraordinary situation. And there was no media training, the sort of the way that people went on. And not so much in snooker, actually, but certainly in other sports. They're very trained and very, because they do so many interviews, they know what to say and when to say it and how to get the points across and how to sort of, you know, the intonation and all that. He just said off the top of his head, I'm in the final now, you know. And it was a kind of exclamation of disbelief, a bit like Joe Johnson, as I mentioned earlier. I'm in the final now, you know. Like, he couldn't think of anything else to say. When he got to the final again in 1988, he came, I mean, I wasn't there, but I've seen footage of it. He went into the press conference room, and the press said it to him. They said the same words back to him. You're in the final now, you know. It's a lovely moment, that, and I think speaks to maybe a more innocent time. But obviously that was the start of, in many ways, a different era for snooker, because I know a lot of people, Joe Johnson was one of them, and various others, who said, well, if Terry can win the World Championship out of the blue, maybe we can make a go of this. And, well, So many people did, of course. Now we're into the top 10. At number 10, and this is also, quite a few people have mentioned this, and I think this is good because, again, it's about the audience as much as it is the players. This was 2011, the start of the final session of the final. John Higgins and Judd Trump made their entrance to incredible scenes, the crowd on their feet, and it was genuine. And there were, I think there were, well, there's three reasons for it. One, it was a very exciting World Championship final that was about to have its final session. Two, it was an interesting clash of generations, of styles. You've got John Higgins, who at that point, of course, had won it three times already, played the all-round game. And Judd Trump completely lit up that tournament. He was a new player to so many people, very exciting player. I remember Ed Miliband tweeting about how excited he was to watch him. There's a name from the past. But yeah, he really got the sort of the juices flowing as a new player, young player, sort of natural person to support, really. But the other reason, and I think it's worth mentioning him because this is a sign of how, in a lot of ways, snooker has changed at the Crucible, never mind as a sport, is Rob Walker. Rob Walker, the MC, hadn't been doing it that many years before then, but the thing about Rob, and we've heard him mentioned earlier in regards to Dave Gilbert, he very much is all about how the emotions of human life translate to sport. It's not, to Rob, sport is not some clinical results business. It's about the people. If you go back into the 80s, I mean, I saw not so long ago footage on YouTube of the 1987 semi-final between Steve Davis and Jimmy White. Now, that's a great matchup straight away there. The MC then, a guy called David Harrison, he was actually, wasn't necessarily his first job. He had other responsibilities, but he introduced the players very professionally, but it was literally, please welcome, you know, the world number two or whatever he was, Jimmy White. And now, you know, three times champion as he would have been then, Steve Davis. It was all very polite, and that's how it was done then. Alan Hughes came along as Master of Ceremonies a couple of years later, and he changed it. He made it a bit more sort of showbizzy, because Alan was old school showbiz, gave it a bit more glitz and glamour. But then Rob came along and reinvented it again. And what I would say about Rob is he genuinely, and I mean genuinely, wants everyone, from the moment they walk in that building to the moment they leave, to have the best time they can. And so he will go out and welcome them and try and make it into an occasion and try and emphasise the importance of the occasion to the players, not just in sporting terms, but as I say, in human terms. And he did all of that on that night, and it resulted in that reaction. So Rob was a big part of that. Obviously, John Higgins and Judd Trump were also big parts of it, but it was a very memorable moment for sure. Now, number nine, this is from 1995, the semi-final, Stephen Hendry potting the last black of his 147 against Jimmy White. Someone mentioned earlier, and it's true actually, because Hendry was so dominant, I mean, he won it seven times, but actual single moments are actually quite hard to come by. I mean, he beat Jimmy with a session to spare in 1993, but what's the single moment there? Even 92, when he came back and won, you know, he finished off with a couple of centuries. So when we look for iconic moments, oddly enough, Stephen, despite being, you know, one of the absolute all-time great players, not only at the Crucible but everywhere else, it's kind of harder to find. Now, his first appearance, I guess, could come into that. When he was just 17, but I've chosen this one. He pots a great last black. It's a cutback. It's the first time there'd ever been a maximum in the one table setup. And great commentary by Clive Everton and John Spencer. But that moment, I think, and that pot in a way, sums up Stephen Hendry, because it was missable for sure. I mean, it would be missable in a way if you were right behind it, because it was a big first prize and all the rest of it. But also just the glory and the drama of the moment. But he wasn't going to miss it because he was Stephen Hendry. And that's the point, really. You know, even though it was tough, so was he. And my word, he proved that over the years. Number eight, 1982 semi-final. The break from Alex Higgins. The blue is the moment, I think, there. That blue with all the whatever he had on the cue ball to get it to where he got it. I mean, people have tried to recreate that shot, and it's very much a shot that you associate with him. You know, if you're going to pick an Alex Higgins shot for his whole career, that would be the one. And of course, it was early on in the break. He went on to make the clearance to win the match, to win the tournament. I mean, I can't even begin to imagine what it would have been like to have been in the arena for that. Alex Higgins, Jimmy White, that break, that match, that time. Incredible.
Incredible.
So that's number eight. Number seven is from 1981, and it's after the Steve Davis has won the World Championship against Doug Mountjoy. Barry Hearn barrels across the Crucible stage, runs across, and nearly knocks him over, runs into him. And this moment, I mean, it was a joyous moment for them. It represented so much, and it was really twofold. Well, actually, it was threefold. It was about the past, the present, and the future. The past, in terms of the journey they'd been on together. Steve walked into Barry's club one time to play in a tournament, and Barry was, it was suggested by someone, he went and looked at him, they met. They're very different characters. Barry gregarious, Steve introverted, but they clicked, and he started to manage him, and, you know, they got to the present, which was the moment of victory. So the realisation, everything we've been working for, we've actually achieved, we've become world champion. But then the future, I swear, if you squint, you can see pound signs in Barry's eyes as he's giving that sort of fist up to the Romford crew in the corner. Because he must have felt in that moment, okay, we've now got potential to do something special. And of course he did. He marketed Steve like no player had ever been marketed. Steve was the talisman, Barry was the mastermind behind it. And between them, they cleaned up on and off the table and changed snooker. Let's be clear, they changed snooker. So much of the internationalisation of snooker, overseas tours, all of that was Barry. The commercialisation of the game, you know, I mean, they had duvet covers at one point. So I think they had a matchroom condom at one point, but anyway, good if you're playing safe, I suppose. But Steve, of course, you know, on the table, just carried on winning. He seemed unaffected by fame, seemed to quite enjoy it, actually, and was just that great, respectable, professional figure that so many young boys of that generation looked up to. If you speak to John Higgins, he was his hero. Ronnie O'Sullivan tells a story in the watching the 85 final, the climax of it in the club, and everyone wants Steve to lose. And he wants Steve to win because he recognises what he is and what he represents. So many boys of that time, and girls, I'm sure, would copy his cue action, would you know, even to the sip of water. You'd see people in snooker clubs sipping water, like Steve Davis. He was an incredible figure in the sport. And that moment, I think, told us a lot about what was going to come in the 80s, that boom period, the two of them leading the way, Steve Davis and Barry Hearn. Number six, maybe not so, well, not, maybe about it, not so happy for Steve, was that Miss Black in the 85 final. And the no from Ted Lowe is what made it, because it's actually, I mean, it was a different time, a different style of commentary. But it's very bold to just say one word on a moment like that. You can imagine now, I don't think it'd be quite as minimalist. And times have moved on, let's be clear. But to just say no, and it's the most, there's so much loaded in the way he says it. The concern, the confusion, the disbelief, it's all, and it's only two letters, no, but it's all in there. And of course, Steve slinks back to his chair, fearing the worst, and he was right to. 1994 is number five, and this is, of course, the 18-17 win for Stephen Henge over Jimmy White. But the iconic moment is Jimmy's comment when David Vine goes over to interview him. He says he's beginning to annoy me, and I could have chosen the Miss Black, but I think actually the quote is a better choice because it's actually more representative of Jimmy as a person. Remember when Steve lost in 85, he could barely speak. He sort of spat out that line about, you know, it happened in black and white, because he was so used to winning. It was a real blow. Jimmy, I'm afraid, had got used to not winning. And what we saw there in that moment was the gracious person he is, the warm person he is, that even in that moment, he manages to make a joke of it. He manages to be a human being in that moment. And it's that sort of cheeky, cheery way that he had about him that, of course, endeared him to so many people. So many people loved him because he could be like that. Now, had he been a sort of harder-headed type, like a Davis or a Hendry, maybe he would have won it. But the reason people loved Jimmy, apart from how he played, of course, which is incredible as well, was because he was like that. He was human, and he could, in that sort of irrepressible way, shrug it off like that. How he felt afterwards, we don't know, but in that moment, to be able to say that, I think is incredible. And it's been announced actually this week, or confirmed this week, there is actually a biopic of Jimmy's life that's gone into production, so I don't know when that'll be out, but I think they're filming later in the year, so maybe next year. But that's bound to be fascinating viewing. So we've got four to go, and number four I've chosen 1997. Ronnie O'Sullivan makes the maximum in 5 minutes, 8 seconds, and at the end, the iconic moment, he throws his chalk into the crowd, and you see him looking at someone in the player's box, sort of miming, I need some more chalk. And what I love about that is, it's kind of, it was spontaneous, which he kind of is, but also just the flair and the sort of panache with which he's made the break, and the next thing is, you know, he's asking for a piece of chalk. To me, that was the true arrival of a box office star. He'd already won the UK Championship, yes. He won a few tournaments, but it was kind of a bit erratic, the winning. But that was the moment on, I mean, in some ways it's the smallest stage geographically, but it's the biggest stage in the sport, the biggest stage in snooker. He announced himself. It was actually the first of the, it was the fourth Crucible Maximum, the first to be shown live on television. That's a fact. And that's quite significant in its own way. I remember it made the national news, and Michael Burke, I remember on the main 9 o'clock news, there's footage of him explaining what happened. It was just a very, he doesn't do small, Ronnie, he does big, doesn't he? It was mentioned earlier, you know, the maximum to win the Welsh Open, his 1,000th century came in at the last frame of a final. He's capable of these big moments, and this, it wasn't the first of them, but it was one of the most significant in his early career. It was a big moment that said, this guy is special. This, there's something about this guy, he's going to be a big star for many years to come. And my word, well, he goes into this year's favourite. So, you know, we're talking now 27 years on. So that turned out to be true. Three to go, number three. 1983, Cliff Thorburn pots the last black of the first World Championship Maximum. Good luck, mate, says Jack Carnham as he's about to play it. Cliff sinks to his knees. The thing about that break, and it's kind of the opposite to Ronnie's in a way, is it took a long time. Ronnie's didn't. So you were sort of mesmerised by O'Sullivan's. There wasn't really time to even focus on what was happening. But with Cliff's, the drama built up. And by the end, he'd actually, here's the thing, okay, I mentioned my dream that John Higgins was going to play Sean Murphy in this year's World Final, which I had twice. But Cliff actually dreamt his maximum a couple of months before he made it. Not obviously the exact way he made it, but he dreamt he was going to have one. There's actually several iconic moments within that break. There's the fluke that he has at the start. There's the yellow. There's Bill Werbenek peeking round the corner. There's the hug at the end with Terry Griffiths and Bill, and then obviously Cliff. I actually love the way he grabs his cigarettes. And as he walks off, he's punching the air and clenching his fist, and you see the cigarette packet. All of that. But clearly the moment is when he pots the black. And Jack Carnham's commentary, good luck, mate, you know, he's a big part of that as well. So down to the final two. And number two is 1982, Alex Higgins tearfully beckoning his baby daughter Lauren or his wife Lynn anyway, to bring Lauren, his baby daughter, to join him. He's got the trophy already. Now, John Skilbeck, he wrote Goody Two Shoes, the book about the 1982 World Championship, and it's revealed in there, Nick Hunter, the executive producer, reveals that actually, before that happened, they were about to go off air because they were overrunning and there was another programme on, but they managed to stay on, and, you know, but for that, we may never have seen that moment. Again, it was spontaneous, and I think the best moments are, he hadn't planned to cry, it was just an honest reaction to seeing his daughter, and the thing about Higgins, and so much has been said about him and will continue to be, but, you know, he was clearly a very emotional character, up one minute, down the next. But at that moment, and it was a brief moment really in his life, everything came together. He got all the things he wanted. He was on top of the snooker world as world champion. He had his wife and his daughter there. Everything for that moment was rosy for Alex Higgins. It didn't stay that way. And tragically, you know, things went bad later on. But that is something that still, I think, people will look back on and remember and understand. I think that's the other thing. You can empathise exactly with how he felt. But number one, and it had to be, it's Dennis Taylor potting the black to beat Steve Davis in 1985. The finger wagging, holding up the cue. Unbelievable. I mean, nothing really summed up snooker in the 80s more than that moment. That was the most watched moment in snooker history on British television. But also, and this is the point really, it wasn't just it was one of the great moments on British television in the 80s. It wasn't just about sport. Snooker by that stage had transcended sport. It was central to people's lives. Your nan watched it. Your sister watched it. You know, your best friend watched it. Everyone watched it in the 80s. It was in people's living rooms. These figures, these players, were like family to people. Honestly, they were on, you know, they're in the TV magazines, they're on the kids' TV shows, they're on game shows, they're on chat shows. Steve Davis went on the Morecambe and Wise show. They were everywhere. They were giants. And that moment, it all kind of, it was like a big sort of peak of all the interest. A final that goes down, not only to the last frame, but to the last ball. In Dennis Taylor, in a way, he looks an unlikely world champion in any sport. He's wearing the big glasses, which earlier in his career, he was a bit of a figure of fun for. But he had the last laugh. And that moment where he's wagging the finger, that's to Trevor East, who was, in fact, at the time, ITV's executive producer of snooker, but a big friend of Dennis's, had him on the ITV commentary team. And there was a bit of, I told you we could do it. You know, these I always think about that. You know, you don't have to have either been alive or been old enough to have watched it. You've seen it. You understand what it means. And it was, whether it was the best quality final, I don't think it was, but it was the great moment that told everybody that snooker is here to stay. This is a sport that people love. They love the characters. They love the drama. And let's be honest as well, they love the Crucible. And the World Championship, of course, you know, we have a lot of tournaments now, but already we're a week or so away, a couple of weeks away. People are getting excited. You're seeing people saying they've got the tickets and they're looking forward to seeing this player, and they think this player will win, and they're hoping this player qualifies. All of that, still the excitement nearly 40 years on from that moment in 1985 when Dennis Taylor potted the last black to become world champion. So that's it. And I want to thank everybody for writing in and sharing their memories. And yeah, we'll have more created, I'm sure. How many more years they'll be created at the Crucible, I can't say. I think everyone's aware that the contract runs out in 2027. There's been a lot of discussion about it might leave, and, you know, they want a bigger venue in Sheffield or a bigger venue somewhere else. We don't know the answer to that. We'll find out soon. I think a lot of people feel it's quite likely to leave, and that will be a decision that, you know, we're not going to make, but will be made in the coming years. And listen, I'm sure there'll be people who hear this and you know, bean counters and such, you'll say, they'll think, well, you know, why are all these people getting sentimental over a building? It's a snooker tournament. What does it matter where it's played? You know, these people that we've been on this podcast for an hour, they've written in, they don't understand the commercial world or modern sport. They're the past, not the future. Well, fine. You can say all that if you want. I feel sorry for you if you do. Because here's the thing, okay? None of the moments we've shared in this episode have had anything to do with money. What we've experienced, thanks to that building in Sheffield, the Crucible, is magic. And remember this, okay? They can move it, and the tournament may change, it may grow, it may be different. One thing they can never take from any of us is our memories. Don't let it be forgot that once there was a spot for one brief shining moment that was known as Camelot. Goodbye, bye. Sports Social Podcast Network.